Joining me today, I have Stephen Yu of the highly successful Blue Whale Capital Growth Fund, where you recently started that in 2017. What compelled you, Stephen, to get into fund management?
So I've always have a passion in the financial market. So my background was I was a trained engineer at uni. But as soon as I left my school, I decided to go into fund management. And I think before I started Blue Whale, I've been working in the industry for over 15 years. And I think it's exciting times. And given that the objective for Blue Whale is really to showcase that significant outperformance could be achieved with a lot of hard work. And that's what we're about.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the performance today. I mean, it's worth highlighting for sure.
Yeah. So since we started the fund back in September 2017, we have delivered 2x the return of the equivalent benchmark MSCI World. So the MSCI World net GBP has gone up about 25%, and then we are just up short of 50%. And a year to date, the fund was up about 33, and then the market was up about 23. So we have delivered our
your promise,
our promise or agenda. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think that your fund brings that most other funds seem to not bring?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things quite unique to our approach. I think firstly that we have decided to run a high conviction strategy, which means highly concentrated portfolio of about 25 to 35 companies. And on average, we have been investing into less than 30 companies. And I think typically, if you go through our peer group or across different sectors, a lot of funds would be running about 60, 70 stocks in general. I think in particular in the global space, it's not unusual that you run with over 100 stocks because the equivalent benchmark would be 1,600. So even with 100 stocks, it's not that excessive. But in order to generate significant outperformance, you do need to have high conviction in the stocks that you pick, that you invested into. And then for us, 25 to 35 is the right number. And then secondly, all the research is done in-house from scratch. So we do not use any sell side or brokers research. And typically, I think if you have less resources in the team, so there's a team of four, and then we have just hired the fifth member of the team who's going to come on board in a month's time. So that would be five of us in the team covering about 25 to 30 companies. And the amount of research that we can do would be much more significant if you have less resources and running more stocks.
Why do you think this sort of high conviction but highly concentrated approach when looking at global companies is rare in the industry? Or
I think for us that it's still quite a short period for us. So we've been running a strategy for about 2 years. And if you look across the market, that actually there's been a lack of fund manager taking active bets. So there's a lot of funds that they just want to cross the track the benchmark or the index. Why would that be? I think from my take, it's probably keeping the asset. So they get paid because in the long only space or the mutual fund space, the fund manager get paid irrespective whether they generate good performance or not, as long as the money is still there. So I think in the industry, it has evolved over time to become more of like a branding and marketing thing. So you see a lot of adverts showcased, oh yeah, we're doing all that stuff. And then if you really go into the performance, there's not a lot of performance there. And I think the market is now punishing the industry a little bit to a lot of investors have decided to go into the passive strategy, just basically not pay much fees and go into a passive tracker. Mm. And I have to argue that it's not easy to run a high conviction portfolio. So the amount of work that we do in-house is enormous.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's a big commitment. It's a big commitment.
Do you think that, what sparked you to sort of take this, because it's kind of a risk to sort of have high conviction. What compelled you to go this path? Is that a more difficult path?
I think for us, I think our take on this would be more to do with the fact that this is the right right thing to do. So if you want to invest into a company, surely you want to know everything about a company. And typically, if you have less resources and you're investing into a lot of companies, let's say 100 companies, 75 companies, the amount of time that you can spend on a single company is not going to be a lot. And I work out between between two members of the team, if you're running like 75 stocks portfolio, working 10 hours a day between the two of you, you probably spend on average 5 hours per company per month. At Blue Whale, there are four of us about to become five. And if we're covering about 25 companies, we would be spending 8 to 10 times more per company compared to anyone else. And I think that is the right thing to do. So if you do less work, so typically what happened is you would have a much smaller position, and hence you ended up with a massively diversified portfolio with 7,500 stocks. And then the performance is a byproduct of that you don't get good performance.
Yeah. So when you look at all these companies and you do all of the research, are you looking both at bottom up and top down? Are you looking at valuation as well as potential upsides?
Yeah. So the investment philosophy is very simple. And we want to invest into high quality businesses at an attractive price, so at an attractive valuation. And the approach for us is everything is bottom up. So we start from with the company, and then we try to factor in the macro uncertainties, a lot of noise in the market, whether it's China slowing down, whether Trump is raising tariff, et cetera, on a company level. So anything that have an impact on the company's earnings or revenues or in terms of pricing, et cetera, then will be relevant to us. So everything is done on a bottom-up basis. But ultimately, finding high-quality businesses is probably the easier part of the equation. But finding high-quality businesses at an attractive price require a lot of work. And I think that's where our expertise or where the hard work comes in.
Right.
Yeah.
So at the moment, in your fund is about 10 to 13% cash at the moment. Could you explain where this number comes from?
Yep. So typically on when we first started, the cash position was a bit much lower. So typically, I think you should expect that we will be running at less than 5% cash. So the fund would always be fully invested. And the reason that and also at the same time that this is not a top-down fund, so I haven't taken a top-down view to say, oh, the market is a bit heated and hence we need to raise above cash. Nothing to do with that.
Interesting.
So everything is to do with valuation of the companies in the fund. And if you recall in Q4 last year, I think that was the time that we were less confident about the valuation of a lot of our holdings. And hence we have reduced some of our names, and also we have sold a few holdings. And we started the year on average about 13% cash to date.
Right.
But assuming that the market continue to be quite strong, means a lot of our holdings or universe remain expensive, then I think you should expect the cash level to stay high. But as soon as if the market... have a setback or reset, then we would love to see that, because then we can redeploy our cash at a more attractive price. But at the moment, it's quite a strict discipline that we have put in place in-house to make sure that we're doing the right thing for our investor. But I think last point I want to make on that is, I think the one comfort that we got year to date was the fund still managed to deliver up to about 10% ahead of the index on the back of about 13% cash. So that was... good.
Speaks volumes. Yeah, that was good. So do you think it's important to highlight the fact that even though you could have doubled down on some of your highly performing positions, you've decided not to because of your mandate to get in at a good price?
Correct. Typically, I think people would argue this. Why don't you just redeploy the cash into the existing holding? But for us, that would be an absolute position size that we want to take in a company. That is a reflection of how much conviction we have. That's a reflection of how attractive the valuation is. That's a reflection of how high quality the business is. So if you were just to redeploy the cash and size up all the position in the fund, then that would be the wrong thing to do. Then you'll be taking probably undue risk on stocks that we don't feel that we have the same level of conviction. Mm. So we probably took the hard road to maintain the cash level until we find good enough ideas, which we're working quite hard on at the moment.
Mm. And so in your top 10 holdings, a lot of them are US-based companies, and you sort of have a general sector breakdown of tech, healthcare, as well as consumer discretionary. Is that a byproduct of you selecting good quality companies first, or did that come before selecting good companies?
100%. So everything is done from bottom up.
Mm.
And it's a coincidence that so at the moment we're running about 70% position in the US, exposure in the US. It's a coincidence that the MSCI will have about 60-ish%. For us, we cover about 100 stocks, high quality businesses, how we define it. And 2/3 of our universe are US companies. And typically I think this is the new world that we are in, that there's a lot of global businesses with a lot of technology, or they're disruptors. They're typically the US companies.
Yeah.
And I think I started as a UK fund manager myself, and I've covered European companies before.
Mm.
And I think if you look at the world now, there's been a lack of high quality business or global business in Europe that can actually disrupt kind of the competitors in the US. I think it's most of the time it's the other way around. It's the US counterpart disrupting European companies.
Yeah. So you're originally from Hong Kong, or do Hong Kong stocks or emerging market stocks interest you at all?
So we do spend some time covering some of the larger names in Hong Kong, such as Alibaba, Tencent, and a few others. But at the moment that we do not have any exposure, because we are slightly concerned about the landscape in China. Not that we're taking a top-down view, but of course, when you try to forecast how much Alibaba is going to sell to the consumer, then it will
you
be
have
down
to take that into account.
Then you need to take into account whether what's the credit. What was the credit cycle in China now? What is the banking system? How is it going to play out? And then if you don't get any certainty or conviction that it's going to be fine, then we want to stay on the sideline, but we do cover those companies.
Very interesting. Yeah. So while you don't take a purely top-down view, you do have to take into account sort of macro views on the world economy, because you have to forecast what these quality businesses can sell and who can buy their products. Is there something in the markets that's caught your attention recently?
Yes. I think this, you can argue this in both ways, but I think one thing that you can probably see that the market is peaking a little bit is that there's been a lot of company that came to the market to IPO, and typically they are not making any money. So we recently have Lyft and Uber, and I think we're going to have WeWork shortly.
Mm.
And I think the common thing about all these companies, they're all global companies, they're all doing quite well in terms of expanding expanding their footprints, etc. But the common theme for all these companies, they're cash flow negative on an ongoing basis. And in order for them to make any money in time, they would need to make sure that they are the only player in the market that they can leverage on their economy of scale. And I think what you're saying now is you see a lot of companies rushing to the market to the IPO before it's too late.
Before it's too late. Are you worried about the current yield environment, the fact that we've had low rates for almost a decade now, over?
I think for us, we are equity investor, so we invest into stocks. For us, it's a great thing, because we are probably in some sort of like a Goldilocks scenario, that the rates is not very high. The biggest concern in the market was last year in Q4, that the market was very worried about the Fed raising interest rate too quickly or too much. But of course, the tone has been changed, and we are going to see tonight whether Fed is going to cut the rates. And the rates staying at 2-3% 10-year, US 10-year, is great for equities, because, it just makes equities quite attractive.
Mm, when you compare it to the
alternatives. Compared to anything else, yeah.
Yeah. Are you worried about recession risk at all?
I would say that a typical recession is a normal course of an economic cycle. So recession is great, because it basically filters out a lot of bad companies, or a lot of companies that have done quite well recently on the back of a good economic tailwind, but actually they are very cynical in terms of how they trade over cycle. For us, if you go through our holdings, that we are, I would suggest that we are extremely well positioned into a recession. So a recession is not something that we worry about, because I think this is a typical course of the economic cycle. And then for us, our objective is deliver superior return over cycle. So not over 2 years that we've done, but over a full cycle. But then if you recall, I think it catch a lot of people. I mean, it catch some people's attention that people say, oh yeah, the market's too expensive now, we're going to recession. The market could go down, I don't know, like 40-50%, et cetera. It won't happen, because the last recession that we had was a global financial crisis led by the banking system collapse of the banking system in 2008. And that was what caused the recession to be so severe. But in typical recession, I mean, the market would come up quite quickly. So you're talking about probably the market could go down maybe 20%, I'm guessing. And then it could recover quite quickly, because the Fed would then be cutting interest rate, coming up with quantitative easing, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is not something that I'm concerned too much. But if you ask me one thing that I'm concerned about, which we have little exposure to, would be a financial crisis from China. Because if there's some sort of like a banking system collapse in China, just like what happened in the US or Europe 10 years ago, then the world could suffer. So there's a lot of, globalization means everything is interlinked. So there's not a lot of decoupling, even though that it happened within China, but that would be probably a bigger concern than a recession.
Hmm. So while you aren't necessarily worried about the holdings in Blue Whale Capital of a recession, is that because you find most of the companies in your holdings aren't necessarily exposed to a large extent to this risk?
So if you go through our holdings, or part of our process is, because we do not take a top-down view on the macro. Mm. We try to factor in the macro uncertainty on our assumptions on how much money this company is going to make. And for exactly the reason that, because we do not know which way this is going to go, then we will try to avoid macro if we can. Of course, everything is interlinked, so you can't do it like 100%. You can't have a company that is like basically have zero exposure to the economic cycle. It doesn't work like that.
Mm.
But if you go through our holdings, we do score our holdings based on recession proof. So typically, I think if you go through our entire portfolio, that we will probably say that we will probably have like 1/3 of companies that are a bit more sensitive to the macro, and the other 2/3 are going to be very fine.
Mm. During the last few quarters of 2018, when a lot of investors were pulling their hair out after most stocks sort of sold off, is that where you were doubling down, deploying cash?
We didn't actually. It was slightly, it's less straightforward last year. So if you look at our performance last year, that the fund was up 8.6% for the iShares class, and the market was down 3% for the year. And then the peer group, our iGlobal peer group, was down about 6%. But if you break the performance down by quarter, in Q4, the fund was actually down about 11.5%, in line with the MSCI World and also in line with the IA Global. But we didn't lose any of the performance in Q1 to Q3. Hence, we ended up in a positive territory. But in Q4, what we actually did was that we have, because that was the world, I mean, that was a time when the market was expecting the Fed to raise the interest rate to a level that the market can't bear.
Mm.
And for us, that we want to make sure that our holdings have as little exposure as possible to this cycle, the interest rate cycle. And hence, we have actually reduced a lot of names that might be slightly sensitive to the cycle. And hence, when you asked me earlier that why are we running about 13.8% cash, that was on the back of Q4.
Right.
And I think the small mistake that we could have done better this year was that we wanted to redeploy the cash that we raised in Q4, but the market, as we all know, has recovered so quickly.
Yeah.
That there wasn't any chance. The market is up. The market is up like 25% this year.
Yeah.
And it was and we can't just like invest in stuff that we're that is not attractively price.
Yeah. What do you think about the liquidity of funds and regulation surrounding it? Is that a concern for you, given your fund is not enormous, but investors might sort of get cold feet when there's bad performance?
So liquidity is an extremely important feature of of our strategy. So if you go through our holdings, that the average market cap of our holdings in the fund are over 100 billion pounds market cap. So they're very large companies. And since day one, when we decided to set up the fund and run the fund, is like, this is a flagship product from Bluewell. So we want to make sure that we can actually manage a lot of money if we become successful. And liquidity is the most important thing. So when we first started 2 years ago, that we were running about 25 million pounds. Now we've just gone past 200 million. And in time, we might go to maybe 2 billion. But that's no change. That's been no change since the last 2 years. Basically, we have 10, I mean, we're running a lot more money now compared to when we first started. But if we do run a lot more money now compared to today, we wouldn't need to change our strategy, because we do have a focus, deliberate focus on large cap companies, global companies.
Right. Do smaller companies interest you at all if you reach a certain size?
So the smallest company in the fund is over $5 billion market cap. So that's the smallest we'll go. So if you're talking about anything below that, we wouldn't. And in time, that we will probably have a fewer of those.
Yeah.
So I think if you look at our strategy, that we feel that we can do a lot in the larger cap space.
Yeah.
To generate the level of performance that you have seen so far.
So you don't necessarily need to find smaller companies, but maybe just other bigger companies that are higher quality.
Yeah, not for this strategy. So for this strategy, that this is a flagship fund, we focus on large companies. Liquidity profile is very important as a feature of this fund. So we don't need to deviate from that. But if you try to debate whether we would do even better if we go into a smaller company, then I would argue yes.
Yeah.
But that is not for this product. So that would be for something else.
Of course.
In time.
Yeah. Let's talk about a few different industries, some bigger companies. So what do you think about, say, defense companies? Are there any that's caught your attention?
We don't actually cover defense companies. So for the defense company like BAE System, Lockheed Martin, and the lots, we feel that there are a couple of things that we don't like about them. One is that they're too capital intensive. And secondly, it's too much dependent on trade relationship between governments. So I think, as we all know now, it's quite a tricky situation that even Saudi Arabia, who has been a good friend to the UK, selling military arms and stuff to them, it could change.
Yeah.
So for us, because we don't, going back to our strategy, because we have to admit that we have little idea on how all this relationship goes, and it's all done in a closed door.
Right.
Then if you don't have an insight on how it all works, then it's difficult for us to have conviction in the holdings or in our forecast.
Right. What about media companies, entertainment companies? A lot of them have become very popular nowadays. Netflix, Disney, for example, both US-based companies, both on growth trajectories, some would argue.
We haven't got an investment in both companies. And in particular, I think Netflix is another example that we feel that it is probably too overpriced for what it is. So Netflix is quite interesting case study, because if you go through the top line or the strategy to basically increase the number of subscribers, to increase the in-house contents, to go into a lot of new countries to create localized content, etc., it all works out. But then if you look at what the market is expecting from Netflix in terms of the margin, sustainable margin they can generate, is quite high. Because if you go through the consensus from today going out for 3 years from the market is expecting that Netflix is going to generate over 20% operating margin. And from our take on this, is Netflix is probably going to achieve that, but that is not sustainable. Because what Netflix is about is a platform for content. Of course, they have some in-house content, but that's not the majority. I mean, they just lost their license to stream Friends and also, I think, The Office. And in time, they would have to spend more money to compete for content. And they are, at the moment, they're already spending about $10 billion a year. And you are competing not with the likes of, let's say, ITV or BBC. You're competing with the likes of the really big guys like the Disney, the Hulu, the YouTube, the Amazon Prime, and all that stuff. And as we all know, the value of content will only go up in value. So now you're bidding $10 billion. In a few years' time, you'll be bidding $20 billion. Yeah. And where do you make the money? And it will be difficult when you have more players offering to us as a consumer. Then yeah. the pricing it needs to be quite competitive. Mm. So we are not interested in Netflix.
Yeah. So you're a long fund. Do you ever feel sort of the urge to go short some companies?
We don't. So I think in today's world, because I think there's not been a short of money in the market, and I think what you have seen since the financial crisis is that not only that we have a lot of quantitative easing, but then there's a lot of company that basically have gone on the way to make acquisitions. So shorting companies is actually quite tricky. So of course when we go through our research, that we would have probably we would have come to a conclusion that a lot of companies that we deem as low quality, but shorting them is another matter. So right. Avoiding them is one thing. And if you're actively shorting them is another matter. So for us, we don't do that.
Yeah. So a lot of the companies in your holdings include software companies, highly popular ones like Amazon, but also some perhaps companies people may not necessarily be interested in, like Adobe, like Autodesk. Tell me a little bit about these two companies. And
so we do have quite sizable exposure to software names like Adobe, Salesforce, Autodesk, etc. And what is interesting about Adobe, I think Adobe is the best company that we can use that as a case study, is that Adobe has been a traditional software company for a long time. We're talking about the days of Microsoft. I mean, it's been around for like 30 years. So it's not a new company like Salesforce. But what is interesting about Adobe is the business model has evolved since the adoption of cloud or the introduction of cloud, and also since the introduction of smartphones. And what happened to Adobe was back in 2012-13, so about 5 years ago now, 7 years ago now, that they have their entire business model has evolved from selling CDs, so basically selling you the Photoshop CDs that you have to buy off the shelf and install it, to 100% cloud. So now it's done, everything is done on subscription. And they know exactly what you have subscribed to, and they know exactly maybe there's some like new products that they have been letting you to have a trial, and they can easily push you to do a subscription on that as well. So it makes the distribution model, it's a bit similar to Netflix, but in the software space, in a traditional software space, that the distribution model has completely changed. So not only that is everything is recurring on subscription, so you actually ended up paying more over the course of the software. They can perform updates instantly, so you don't actually need to buy new copies to install. And then thirdly, because there's been an explosion of data and content on the internet with the rise of smartphones, or the increasing penetration of smartphones since Apple has come out with their smartphone 10 years ago now, that there's been more data. So there's been more content that's being consumed by us on YouTube, digital advertising, and Adobe or the Photoshop and all in design and all that product are the market leader in the space. So it's
sort of leverage to this trend. It's beautiful.
Correct. It's beautiful. It's very beautiful because Adobe has been a top 10 holding for us since we started and remain a top 10 holding. So if you look at the absolute valuation of Adobe, it's still trading at a discount over the medium term view to the market.
Would you say that's your favorite holding, or do you have a favorite holding?
It's one of our longer term holdings in the fund. We have many different favorites. I think if you look at our top 10, the top 10 stocks in our fund are the highest conviction part of our portfolio, and it accounts for about up to 50% of the fund. So any names in our top 10, we do like them a lot.
Mm. Is there a particular industry that you like at the moment?
As I said earlier, that we do cover about 100 companies. And the problem for us is not about finding high quality businesses or company like Adobe, but it's whether they are trading at attractive price. Mm-hmm. That is a tricky bit. So we cover, for example, like we cover the luxury names. We do not feel that they're cheap. Mm-hmm. We do cover the consumer staples. We don't feel that they're cheap neither. Yeah. So we are probably lack of opportunities on the valuation front. There's a lot of companies that attract us to it because it's a good business. The industry dynamics is very interesting. But if the price is not right, then we're not going to invest.
Yeah.
Into those company.
It's interesting what you say about Adobe and this sort of rise in this trend of consumers downloading more data, more images, more content. How do you feel about the statement, company success is largely due to the industry or positioning of it in the industry than the individual company itself? Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I think it's a bit of both. Hmm. I think it's important to recognize that there will always be a cycle in an industry. So when we are talking about technology now, technology companies are probably a bigger feature of this fund compared to some of our competitors. But what this fund isn't about is this fund is not about technology. This is a global fund that we have the mandates to invest in any industry or any company that we find interesting at any point in time. But at the moment, we sit here today, that the likes of Adobe, Salesforce, Autodesk, Amazon is the most exciting because we are now in a super cycle of data, cloud, subscription, consumer, being more informed by smartphones. There's a lot of things going on, digital advertising. But all these things could come to a point that become more mature. So if you recall about 10 years ago now, so when I was working as a fund manager running UK Money, at that time that we just came out from the financial crisis. And who was spending a lot of money at that time was China. So China has got this massive stimulus in infrastructure spending. And who is the beneficiary on the other side are the mining company, the oil and gas company, the industrial company. And that was a period of time that you have a super cycle that because there's lots of money to spend in that arena. And if you're a good company at the same time, then you can capitalize the spend, or you can beat your competitor to get more market share. But as we all know, that stopped a couple of years back, about 3 years ago, when China decided not to spend more money, or they are slowing down their spending in infrastructure. They're now promoting more about domestic consumption, etc. So those companies are not going to do as well. So there's always a cycle at the same time. But for us, we are pragmatic in a way that we want to find the best company, but at the same time, we want them to be exposed to some sort of structural drivers. So to answer in a different way is, if you have a great company in a very difficult industry, as a shareholder, it's probably very difficult for us to get decent returns. Like, for example, like a high street retailer. Like how I'm sure there would be some great company on the high street, on Regent Street that have a good brand, that have a good customer base. But if people are shopping less on high street and they spend more money online, then you can't do that well.
So it's a bit of both.
It's definitely a bit of both.
So a few personal sort of anecdote questions. What has been your most contrarian call to date?
I give you two because I'm not sure which context you're referring to. I think two calls that we definitely have. I mean, it's part of Blue Whale's history. I think firstly was that I was quite grateful to Peter Hargreaves who seeded the venture where we have known each other for many years when I first started Hargreaves Lansdown. When I first started that, I have tried to say to potential investor that significant performance could be achieved. But of course, we are living in a world that a lot of funds actually are underperforming the market, and it's easier to sell a ETF or index tracker than saying that, okay, actually active managers can generate good outperformance. And we have set ourselves a quite ambitious target in terms of how much performance we want to generate. Okay, it's not a science, it's not a guaranteed performance, but we do try to work ourselves quite hard in order to achieve that. And I think we're still quite short in terms of track record. So it's only less than 2 years, but at least we have demonstrated that actually it can work. But it's not straightforward because we do have a team of four people working like day on day out, just and focusing on 25, 30 companies. So that, I think that is quite contrarian in the industry perspective. And I think a lot of people that I've met earlier, so in the early stage of Bluewell or before we actually launched the fund, maybe let's say 6 months ago, they probably say, oh, very interesting, but I probably want to have some proof. And I think now, after 2 years, that we get a bit more interest and people come back and say, oh, yes, you did say that you can deliver that. And they started to believe you a bit more.
Yeah.
And then secondly, the second point I can say is a bit contrarian as well, is I think there's been a misunderstanding about our fund that it's a technology fund. So because we have about 40% in technology on our fact sheets. And a lot of people has been calling, there's been a tech bubble. Right, there's been a tech bubble for the last 2 years since we started, and say, oh yeah, we want to avoid technology, we want to avoid funds that might have exposure to technology, and surely Bluewell is going to performance is not sustainable because there's a tech bubble. And I've been saying like that's not been a tech bubble at all in the company that we invested into. Adobe, there's no tech bubble. In Salesforce, there's no tech bubble. Autodesk, there's no tech bubble. But we do have names that I alluded to earlier that, like, say, Uber and Lyft, their business model is not sustainable. And that's a tech bubble for the companies that actually just came to the market. But they're a small part of the market.
Yeah.
They're a very small part of the market.
Yeah. It doesn't apply. A tech bubble doesn't apply if you're selecting companies which aren't part of this tech bubble that people are referring to. Yeah. What has been the most liveliest debate that you've had with your team, your investment team?
So one thing is quite exciting about our team or the culture at Bluewell is we do embrace a open floor debate between the members. So just imagine that there's four of us sitting in a room like here, and everything that we invest into the fund or there might be new ideas that's coming into the fund, we'll debate as a group. Continuously means like from the stage of being a new ideas until the point become a holding in the fund, and then we will debate on a continuous basis on every quarter that there will be new the earnings results, etc. And I think one company that we spent a lot of time debating was PayPal. So PayPal has been a top 10 holding since we started, and until now it's about top 10. So I think it's just at the tail of the top 10. But what is difficult about PayPal is the industry changed quite quickly. So there's a lot of things that happened over the last 2 years. The last 2 years you have, so PayPal was a spin-off from eBay, as you recall. So it's like a PayPal wallet. That's how it got started. But over the last 2 years that you have the Apple Pay, the Google Pay, Samsung Pay, like there's a lot of pay, right? And Amazon Pay. And because disruption is so important as part of our process that we do not like our company to get disrupted. We like disruptors. So PayPal disrupting the traditional payment company like Ingenico and all that, but we don't want PayPal to be disrupted. And talking and debating about or falling disruption is not an easy thing because you don't get all the facts, right? By the time you get all the facts, it will be like 3 years from today.
Yeah.
So during the course of when the disruption might start to emerge, we have to debate and try our best to understand. So is Google Pay going to disrupt PayPal? Is PayPal going to be a relevant technology in 5 years' time from today, etc.? And PayPal is one of the stocks in the fund that we've debated probably. I would probably suggest that over 100 hours between a team of four over the last 2 years. And we still continue to debate because it's there's not going to be a point to say, okay, we can just forget about PayPal, put it in the fund. We don't need to talk about it because things could change.
Do you think there's something that's true that almost nobody agrees with you on?
I probably want to bring this back to the Bluewell approach as well, that we call ourselves a value investor.
Okay.
So Bluewell, we deem ourselves as a value investor. But I think people get confused about value investing, being a value investor or buying value stocks. And if you look at some of our peer group or a lot of funds in the market, maybe not even just in the global, that there's been a lot of funds that hasn't done well over the last couple of years. And typically they invest into lowly price stocks, so low PE stocks, and they would call themselves value investor, investing in value stocks. But that's the most misleading and confusing thing, because investing into value stocks doesn't mean that you're a value investor. Because my take on my take, if you Google it on Wikipedia, value investor purely means that you invest into stocks that are mispriced by the market. It doesn't mean that you buy a company that's trading at 10 times PE. And recently, you will recall that Warren Buffett have invested into Amazon as part of his portfolio.
Yeah. And most famous value investor.
And I would challenge you, like, none of the fund manager that you will speak to who deem themselves as value investor would consider Amazon as a value stock. So I think that's quite misleading. So I've been telling people that we are value investor, but people don't believe us because they look at Adobe, they look at Amazon on our portfolio, or Salesforce, Autodesk. They appear to be expensive. But the reason that they appear to be expensive is because you're looking at the wrong time horizon. If you look at for the next 1 or 2 years, of course, the market's very efficient, then they're going to be expensive. But if you look at take a medium-term view on the likes of Adobe over 5 years, it's actually trading at a significant discount to the market. Mm. And given the certainty that Adobe can deliver in terms of subscription, in terms of the upselling that they can do, more people are subscribing to the software now, then it can actually deliver the free cash flow that we expect them to do so. Mm. And so I will still try to make a case for Blue Whale that we are a value investor, and hopefully in time people will believe us.
Yeah. What are you most looking forward to, or what are you most excited about for in terms of the future of Blue Whale?
So this is probably a bit similar to how we go about investing in company, that we like disruptor. So I do see Blue Whale as a disruptor in the asset management industry in itself. So it's quite a small operation. We are only at the moment running about 200 million. So I think in the scheme of things that we are tiny fish in the pond. But I think one thing that we are quite confident about is if we can keep up with the performance, if we can showcase to the market that we're actually doing something good value for money. Like, basically, it's better that for you to invest with us than to put it in the index tracker or some of our competitor. Then in time, we could become bigger. So we do, and a lot of things that we are doing, that we do have a younger team relatively. We do have an open culture. We try to act or debate on anything quite on a quite pragmatic or open in an open culture.
Yeah,
and I think typically you only find that in a startup, technology startup, but in the asset management space, it's typically you don't get that. There's a bit of a hierarchy that you have committee meetings, and you have a lot of things that you can't do. There's a lot of things that you can't say, but because we are new, so we try our best, and hence we are here today talking about Blue Whale in the studio.
Well, it seems to have paid off. Thank you so much for coming down to the studio today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve,
for having me.